Welcome to the Brighton Book Club on Radio Reverb 97.2 FM, a monthly show about books and writing in Brighton and beyond. On this month's episode, I talked to three local authors, Erica Waller, Beth Miller and Anna Jefferson. Annie Garthwaite tells me about her fundraiser to send 16 young people on an Avon course. I talk self-help trends with Phoebe from Off the Shelf Books podcast, and I discuss Anna Bailey's Tall Bones with KD Books. As always, you can get in contact with us on Instagram at BTN Book Club and email us at btnbookclub@gmail.com. Although we can't take on all of your books and ideas, we consider them all. I hope you enjoy this month's show. Erica Waller joins me now in the virtual Brighton Book Club studio. Erica, welcome to the Brighton Book Club.
Hello, thank you for having me on.
It's our absolute pleasure. So your book, Dog Days, is out now with Doubleday. What is it about?
Dog Days is a life-affirming, poignant, moving story about three characters you'll never forget, according to the blurb, about three strangers who have dogs, some through choice and some because they were foisted on them, all embarking on dangerous moments in their lives and through the help of their dogs. And invariably how those dogs make other people come into their lives, how they find resolution and not necessarily happiness, but they move on in their lives to where they need to be.
Where did the idea first come from for Dog Days?
When I walk my dogs, I walk them up on the Beacon in Rottingdean, which is where the book is set. And I've always been quite fascinated about the lives of the people that I meet there. You know, if somebody's got a cute dog, I'm straight up to them, even if they look maybe potentially like a murderer. If they've got a spaniel, for example, then I think, oh, they can't be a murderer. They're a really nice person because they've got a dog. So I kind of thought about the secret lives of people that you meet when you're walking your dogs. What are they going home to? You know, you see somebody with a bag of poo and a lead and you immediately assume they're safe. So I think I wanted to explore that. And also I thought about how many people, the only time they might see other people is when they go out and they walk their dog. So I remember seeing this one man and he was just walking a lead because his dog had died, but he still went and did the walk because it was the only way he got out of the house. And I found it really heartbreaking. And I thought, there's a story here.
Can you read from the prelude, please?
I can read from the prelude. It's one of those spring mornings you get down on the coast. A scene so brilliant, it reminds you of a child's painting. The sky, a solid block of Crayola blue. The sun scrubs to a radiant beam. On the horizon, crisp white clips of sails like petticoats. The maids curtsy into the shore. The Beacon winks with buttercups and dandelions. The grass does a silent tai chi in a breeze. The mate adjusts the hat to a jaunty angle, but would never be so rude as to whip it off your head. And there is the windmill, casting its shadow on the bodies of Luke and Lizzie, Dan and Atticus, on George and Betty, and even their dogs. Even from this distance, it's easy to spot who belongs to whom, that Fitz and Wolfie belong to Dan and Luke, striding over the mound. Fitz's tail is too long and his tail's too waggy to be perfect, but you'd struggle to find a more decent creature, just like his owner. Wolfie, the flirt, the airhead, the poor simple beast, is distracted from chasing a squirrel by Maud. Lizzie is supposed to be walking her, but it's always the other way around. Betty and George are on the bench with Poppy, who is licking the salt from George's fingers as he eats. Betty is knitting another hideous jumper for her rescue greyhound, Lucky, a coat hanger of a dog who always looks embarrassed but never leaves her side. The rain comes out of nowhere, as it can so close to the sea. The first dollop of water lands on George's thin hair. He tuts. Effing weather. Poppy barks, Fitz and Wolfie roll in something dead and smelly. Lucky's woolen coat starts to itch. And they all look up at the rain, heads tipped back, pale necks exposed to the elements like birds waiting to be fed. They stare that way for a moment before Betty covers her head with a newspaper and George packs away his lunch. Before Luke worries about his hair, before Atticus takes off his coat to give to Dan, who says Lizzie needs it more. And there is a brief moment when time pauses itself and we can see the fragile threads between them glittering like gold in the rain. From a finger here to an elbow there, from the corner of Atticus's smile to Dan's beating heart, from paw to person and back again.
It's such a lovely book, Erica. Congratulations. I'd like to find out a bit about the writing of it. So it's written in three viewpoints. How did you get into the heads of your characters? Did you write them chronologically or separately and then kind of paste them together?
I wrote them chronologically. Mm-hmm. I planned out the book using post-it notes and a lot of hair pulling and Bourneville and pick and mix. And then I wrote it every day. I would go to my computer and I would just write the next scene. And I didn't write them as three separate stories. I wrote them exactly as they are in the book. And George came about very much from my own experience of grief. I mean, you will know the Shoreham Air disaster. Morris Abrahams was a very good friend of mine, a very, very good friend of mine. And I had seen him the morning of the crash, actually. And so George is part Morris in Ode to My Lovely Grumpy Old Man, but also part of grief personified. So George is grief with arms and legs. He's angry and confused and he's scared and he's hurting. So he kind of was conjured up from my imagination of if grief could sort of live in the world. And then Dan, I really wanted to explore a counsellor that had OCD himself, so a counsellor that needed counselling, because I once tried to be a counsellor then realised that I needed an awful lot of counselling. And Lizzie, I wanted to write a really complicated female character that challenged the idea that women have to be mad or bad if they do something wrong. I wanted just to write a fallible person, because I think that we all are.
How does Brighton, Erica, play a part in the writing of the book?
Brighton is my home. I wasn't born here. I fled here when I was about 20 years old, and I came from a very middle class town that I never fitted in. Brighton has always been my spiritual home, and it was a natural place to write this book. It's where the characters came to me, and also I find Brighton to be the most accepting, quirky, artistic place I've ever been to. And so I've set it here. Everywhere I write about is somewhere real. It's somewhere I've been. It's somewhere that's close to me. And it felt in itself, Brighton is a bit of a Labrador of a dog in itself, if you ask me. It's just a very accepting, cool place to be.
Now, Erica, if you were a dog, what kind of dog would you be?
I like to think I'd be really clever. I'm a bit of a Labrador. I stand too close to people. Get really excited. I've got no game at all. It's really obvious. It's really obvious if I'm happy or sad. I sleep an awful lot, and I really like food. I'm a Labrador.
I'm feeling some of those Labrador tendencies. Erica, what are you working on now? What's your next project?
I am working on a book about a family who all get very lost from one another. They all, on the same day, they all have something very momentous happen to them, some good, some bad, and they distance themselves from one another as they go down quite dangerous rabbit holes. And it is a story about communication and the ways we communicate. It's a story about the dangers of social media and male toxicity. It's a story about anorexia and a story about becoming your own hero.
That sounds wonderful. Have you got any idea when it's coming out?
No. I think the paperback of Dog Days is coming out next year. So I imagine it will follow very early 2023, which seems like years away, doesn't it?
Yeah. Erica, how can we find and follow you and get our hands on a copy of Dog Days?
You can find and follow me on Twitter or Instagram at Erica Waller One. Annoyingly, my name is spelled E-R-I-C-K-A, just so you know. Do follow me because I post pictures of my amazing dogs, especially my Brussels Griffon, who, if you don't know, George Lucas owned 7 of them when writing Star Wars, and that is what Wookiee and Ewoks were based on. So I actually have an Ewok dog who's worth a follow in himself. I'm also on Facebook. You can find me mostly anywhere, and you can order the book through Waterstones and Goldthorpe Books and all independent bookshops as well.
Thank you very much for coming on.
Thanks for having me.
I am joined by Beth Miller in the virtual Brighton Book Club studio. Beth's a local author based in Brighton, and her new book, Starstruck, is out with Farrago in August. Welcome, Beth.
Hello, Anna. Lovely to be here.
Thank you very much for coming on. So you have written quite a lot of books, Beth, and I thought we could start off by playing a quick game. And I'm going to read the titles of your previous books, and I'd like you to describe them in one sentence. So let's start with The Missing Letters of Mrs. Bright.
50-something woman changes her life completely and discovers the true meaning of friendship.
Two Hearts of Eliza Bloom.
Orthodox Jewish girl runs away on the day of her arranged marriage.
When We Were Sisters.
That book's so long ago, I can barely remember what it's about. Two girls are friends when they were young. A lot of stuff goes down and then they meet when they're adults.
Ooh, The Good Neighbour.
Look out for your neighbours. They're not always great.
Very good. Okay, and then your two non-fiction. So we've got For the Love of the Archers.
Yes, world's longest running soap, condensed, but don't bother reading it if you're not interested in the Archers. It will be weird.
For the Love of Shakespeare.
For the love of God, how many books did he write? I mean, how many plays did he write? For the person who either does or doesn't know much about Shakespeare, it's fun and accessible.
Absolutely wonderful. So can we talk about your forthcoming book, which comes out, like I said, in August with Farrago? It's called Starstruck. Now, what is it about?
It's about a woman called Sally, who for years has been a tribute artist to the world's biggest pop star, a woman called Epiphany. You'll just have to imagine a kind of mashup of Beyonce and Madonna and anyone really famous. And she's bigger than all those. And then this isn't really a spoiler because it happens right at the start. Epiphany, the real Epiphany, comes into Sally's life and asks if they can swap lives for 2 weeks.
Can you read us some? I'd love to hear this. This is right up my street.
I was 6 years old the first time I saw Epiphany. She blasted onto Top of the Pops, just a teenager herself, already fully formed. She jumped from our screens into our living rooms, and all of us watching were instantly in the palm of her hand. Not long after, the whole world was the same way. That was it for me. I knew then that music would be my career. The most recent time I saw Epiphany, before today, was in March, her last London concert, where she did the famous stunt for Beauty Like Diamonds, flying off the tallest ladder I've ever seen. As Paul said, it would be just the job for the gutters at the back. From where we were sitting, back of the upper circle, it looked like she was wearing barely more than a couple of strategically placed crystals. But on the Jumbotron, you could see there was flesh-coloured material stretched over her entire body. I looked it up later and it was some new space-age material originally designed for burns victims. Turns out it's too expensive to develop for that, but it's perfect for Epiphany's stage costumes. Paul comes to her concerts to please me. He's not a massive fan of the music. He's a Whitesnake chap. In fact, we met at a festival where Love Hunter, the Whitesnake tribute, were playing. But he perked up at the sight of that outfit. Who wouldn't? I obviously don't look like her in the booty department. No one does. Only Beyonce comes close, but Epiphany always beats in those sexiest body lists. I can almost pass as the same species with padding here and corsetry there, but my stage outfits need a different fabric to sequins ratio. Paul always tells me I'm more womanly than her, a polite way of saying fatter. Anyway, she climbed to the top of this ladder and then, still singing, so casually you couldn't believe, she just dived down. Everyone surged forward, but there was an invisible harness, of course, so just before she hit the stage, she swooped up again, spread her arms out, and these iridescent wings attached to her sleeves dropped down, making her look like the most beautiful shimmering bird. I was staring at the Jumbotron while she was dangling there, and for a fleeting second, I saw something pass across her face. Anger, maybe, or pain. It was weird. You never see her like that. I've spent years studying that face, and she always seems completely immune to the basic human emotions. I turned to Paul and said, "Did you see that?" But he clearly hadn't. "I know, incredible," he said. "If you want to do that at your next gig, I'll nip to Screwfix for some carabiners and a bit of rope." I said, "That'd do my back in, that would," and we had a good laugh. So today I come home from Shrewsbury and Epiphany is in my kitchen. I'll say that one more time for those of you in the cheap seats in the upper circle. Epiphany is in my kitchen. This is not a hoax. This is Red Alert. Epiphany, the real, actual Epiphany, is sitting in my chuffing kitchen, in that crappy chair from the car boot. And the dishes still in the sink.
This is such an interesting concept for a book. How did you come up with the idea and what is your research process?
I'm not very good at research. I did do bits of research, but it's not my strong suit. I got the idea for the novel years ago. I've always liked tribute acts. I really love them. I love the whole thing about them. This like campness, the funny names that they have. And then I watched a documentary, a BBC documentary a few years ago, which was about the now defunct Limelight Club in Crewe, which was the place where all the tribute acts wanted to play. And it was just absolutely fascinating. In particular, one guy who played the part of Phil Lynott in a Thin Lizzy tribute was just really interesting and sort of complicated and sensitive about what it means to be a tribute artist. And that idea was rolling around in my head for a while. And then I saw the Graham Norton thing with the Adele Looky Likey competition. I don't know if you've seen that. And the real Adele wearing prosthetics comes and takes part in this competition to see who the best Adele is. And though she doesn't look like herself, and all the other Adeles are amazing, and they look like her more than she does even, as soon as she starts to sing, they all know it's her. And there's something really amazing about it. So it was something about that. It was something about the world of tribute artists, which I find really engaging. So that's that. It just developed from there. I thought, what would it be like if you were a tribute artist and then suddenly you met the person that you did the tribute to and they were interested in talking to you?
You have done many things before you turned your hand to writing, Beth. Can you talk a bit about how you came to start writing?
Well, we've only got about 10 minutes, Anna, so I'll look very quickly. Yes, I've had tons of jobs. I started out in psychology. I've been a psychology lecturer. Then I moved into HIV and sexual health education. And I've been a drugs and alcohol counsellor, and I've run a counselling service for young people. I did all the time that I did these other jobs, I always wrote. I always managed to write newsletters in particular. And then towards the end of my career pre-writing, I worked for New Writing South, who are a writing support agency in Brighton. And I was running the education team, placing writers in schools. And I just was very envious of those writers. I wished I was working in schools with young people doing writing, because I'd started writing a novel in like 2001 or something. And then I took a sabbatical from New Writing South to finish the novel. And well, if this was a fairy story, I'd say, and then it got published, but there was like a lot of years went past before it did, and a lot of crying and throwing up bits of paper. And even now, I'm not just a writer, I'm a book coach as well. I think if I wrote full time, I wouldn't have anything to write about.
So as a book coach, what would your advice be to an aspiring writer?
Well, I do see a lot of people at a very early stage who haven't started writing yet. I get people contacting me and say, I want to write. And the obvious thing to tell them, I mean, I don't charge for this service because I just send them away, is come back to me when you've written 5,000 words. And mostly they don't come back to me. So I assume that either they decide it wasn't for them, or they're on a roll and they're writing. Sometimes they do. And then I say, come back when you've done another 5,000 and then we can talk. So that's the first thing, is just you can't really know what you want to write until you start writing. But then at different stages, I have different advice for people near the end of their manuscript. It's all about raising the stakes. I should get that printed on a T-shirt. Raise the stakes, raise the stakes. But yeah, there's some. I think if I had one thing that would be on my gravestone, it would be persevere. Persevere, because you never know what the end of the story is if you give up.
Absolutely. How can we find and follow you, Beth, and pre-order a copy of Starstruck?
Well, the pre-copy is apparently going to be out in July, but then they'll be available in all the usual places. And Farrago, F-A-R-R-A-G-O, has their own bookshop as well. So it'll be on there, but it'll be on in Amazon and Waterstones, I hope, and all the usual places. And I am on Twitter, Dr. Beth Miller, and I am on Instagram, I think, but I'm not very good at Instagram. And I'm just generally around, and I have a website which is just my name and co.uk.
Thank you very much for coming on.
Thank you very much. It was lovely to be here.
Local author Anna Jefferson's new book, Nailing It, is out now with Orion, and follows her book, which was out in November last year, called Winging It. Anna, welcome to the Brighton Book Club.
Thank you for having me, Anna.
Can you tell us about Winging It and Nailing It?
Okay, so Winging It, which came out last year, was a book based on it's the first year of parenting. It starts off with the protagonist, Emily, as she's in labour with her first child, and follows the relationship of her and her partner as they kind of readjust life to this new way of living. Winging It came out in November last year. And it is the story of Emily as she comes to terms with being a new mum. It follows the first year of parenting for her and her partner, Nick, and the book begins as she's in labour with her daughter. It then kind of follows their kind of experiences as they have to readjust to a completely new way of life. The book was inspired by a blog that I started writing after I had my first child 9 years ago. And the blog was called You Can Take Her Home Now. And it started off as just a kind of story, a way of kind of documenting for myself what the experiences were like of new motherhood, just the kind of the trials, like the good bits and also the kind of not so good bits. And the blog started to gain a bit of following and a bit of traction, and was a brilliant way of being able to connect in with other women as well. So the blog became the inspiration for the book, although the book is very much a work of fiction.
And how does Nailing It follow on from Winging It?
So Winging It follows the life of Emily and her two friends, Tanya and Helen, as they all kind of navigate this first year of parenting. Nailing It reconnects with these three characters, but 5 years later, when their children are five and they have a whole set of different challenges ahead of them, whether that be working out how to co-parent when you have split up with a partner, or the relationship with an aging parent as they come and live with you, and all the trials that follows. But also alongside that, it's very much about, both books are very much about female friendship and about how women support and hold each other up through kind of times of challenge, but also kind of celebrate all the good times together as well.
Anna, can you read the opening, please, of Nailing It for us?
Certainly can. I can pinpoint the exact moment I fell in love with Nick. Not just liked him, but could see a future with him. A proper future with a shared toothbrush holder and insurance on each other's rubbish cars. It wasn't a light bulb moment. We hadn't done anything monumental. We weren't having life-altering conversations or clinging on to each other after knee-trembling sex. It was 15 years ago. We were both 23 and were watching TV in my shared house. It was a disgusting house with black mould lurking ominously in damp corners of the bathroom or creeping up from behind the toilet system like octopus tentacles. The kitchen was circa 1970, but not in a kitsch hipster way. The cooker was a standalone with gas hobs and a pull-out grill at head height. The gas wasn't connected properly, so we had to hold our breath when lighting it, as if that would protect us from some potentially fatal explosion. That was a very real risk. On the night in question, Nick had his arm lazily wrapped around me, his hand resting on my stomach under his t-shirt. Our breathing slow and in synchronicity. We were watching stars in their eyes. Matthew Kelly was interviewing Keith from Bolton, construction worker with a burning ambition to make it as a semi-professional singer on the cabaret circuit. "Thank you, Keith," Matthew grinned. "We'll see you in a minute." And moments later, Keith emerged through the glitter curtains wearing a brown leather jacket and a Paul Weller esque wig. "Christa Berg," I announced confidently. "It's Christa Berg, I bet you a tenner." Keith took the mic and sure as started singing "Don't Pay the Ferryman." "Told you," I beamed and put my hand up. "Cough up, Nick." "Are you joking?" he teased. "Nope, a bet's a bet," I said. He pulled me closer to him and whispered in my ear, "It's Christa Berg night, Emily. They're all Christa Berg." "What?" I exclaimed. "The last guy was singing Lady in Red, and the one before him, Spanish Train. They're all Christa Berg." He laughed unselfconsciously. Nick had the most infectious laugh, and a face that only looks more handsome when he's happy. I clutched my sides as I laughed with him, and he cupped my face. "God, I love you, Emily," he said, and pressed his lips to mine. And in that moment, as I kissed him back, I knew without hesitation that I 100% loved him too.
Anna, your background is in being a playwright, and I would love to know a bit about the difference in writing for stage and writing on the page, and if you feel like it has made you a stronger writer.
Yes, I think so. Although they're very different ways of writing, it's still very much exercising that same muscle. I think with writing for stage, obviously it's all based around dialogue. So, and that's something that I really enjoy. I really enjoy those interactions with people. I think being a playwright is also helpful if you're quite a nosy person. So you're, you know, like listening into conversations on buses and so on. And but yeah, in terms of writing for theatre, you know, you're kind of like writing within a, there are parameters within it. So whatever you're creating, you're also thinking about how that would translate onto a stage. And there's an immediacy about it as well. So when you put a play on, you get a reaction from an audience then and there. If people are laughing, you know, you kind of, you know how people are responding to what it is that you've written. Whereas writing books is, and novels is kind of a kind of a very different experience in that sense, that obviously you kind of the, in terms of people's reactions once you've finished your novel, I kind of compare it to like the longest opening night on history, because your book's out there and then you're waiting to see what people think and see what the kind of reactions are in that sense. But in terms of the fundamentals of writing, I think that writing for stage really enforces the character development in terms of writing writing fiction, because I feel that I can write quite confidently in terms of dialogue within a novel, and I really enjoy that part as well. So I think in terms of the books, there's a lot of character development that happens very much in terms of how people are speaking with each other. So yeah, I think there's definitely quite a relationship between playwriting and novel writing, but I think the way that the process is probably slightly different.
You are based in Brighton, Anna, and I'd love to know what it means to you to be a writer here.
I think I'm really lucky to be a Brighton-based writer. Both novels that I've written so far are firmly based in Brighton. I think that it's a hugely inspiring place to live and work. But also, I was really lucky to join a writing group through New Writing South, probably about 6 or 7 years ago now, which is a group that is 8 of us, all female writers, all published, and we meet up once a month. We've been doing it online recently, of course, but to support and kind of share work, and being part of that community, it feels like there's a really strong writing community within Brighton and the South East. So yeah, I feel really fortunate to be writing here.
And what are you working on now, Anna? Is there another book in the pipeline in this series?
There is another book in the pipeline, but it's not in this series at the moment. So the book that I'm writing at the moment is quite different, about 4 different characters, 4 really different, and their relationship to each other, and about them finding a place called home to themselves. It's quite a fun book to write at the moment. One of the characters is set in a charity shop. So I have been perusing the charity shops of London Road as research, of course. But yeah, so I've moved away from the characters in Winging It and Nailing It for now. But that's not to say that I haven't got plans for them in the future. And I'm thinking about how these characters will develop further as their life moves on and their children become older. And I look forward to reconnecting with them again.
Anna, thank you so much for coming on the show today. How can we find and follow you and buy a copy of your books?
Both Nailing It and Winging It are available in all bookshops and online. If you're Brighton based, there's also City Books in Hove if you wanted to buy local. In terms of socials, I'm on Twitter at Anna Jefferson, and on Instagram at Anna Sean Jefferson Author.
I am joined in the virtual Brighton Book Club studio by Phoebe from Off the Shelf podcast. Phoebe, welcome to the Brighton Book Club.
Hi, Anna. Thanks for having me. I'm delighted to be here. As you said, I have my own podcast and I've always wanted to go on someone else's just to kind of see it from the other side and be a guest. So thank you so much for having me.
So Phoebe, what's the story behind Off the Shelf?
Well, before we just get into the story, I just want to talk about you, Anna. So actually, I got into the Brighton Book Club podcast because I heard your other podcast, which is called the mother of all losses. And I went through a tough time with my mum last year. She has breast cancer and it's now incurable. And she was in a coma with COVID for a bit last year. And I discovered your podcast, The Mother of All Losses, and I loved it. And I honestly, I don't say I creeped on you because that's a bit weird, but I was looking at other stuff you'd done. And this is how I came across the Brighton Book Club podcast. But yes, I do also have my own book podcast. And again, kind of feeding back into my mum, she was very ill last year and I wasn't doing very well. And I had to take a bit of time off work for a couple of weeks. And I was thinking, I'm going to go insane if I don't find something to do with my time. So I set up a book Instagram, and then because all of my friends have always bothered me for book recommendations. I love to read. I've always loved to read. And I'm very handy with a recommendation. And off the back of that, I was thinking, oh, I could set up a podcast. So I did. And it's just kind of gone from strength to strength, really. I've had some great guests on. I've got some great guests coming up. And I just, yeah, I love to talk about, you know, books and reading, and it just gives me an excuse to bother people about it and they can't complain.
So what's the structure of your podcast, Phoebe, and how do you choose your guests?
Oh, very easy. I choose my guests. I either read something or see something I like, and then I do the classic slide into the DM and say, I really like this thing that you've done, like, please will you come on. And you know, maybe they've got me confused with someone else and they say yes, which is lovely. So the structure is guests kind of come on and they talk about their five favorite books. And I was used to, when people would say to me, what's your favorite book, I would freeze. So I was like, oh my god, there's so many to choose from. So I kind of give them a list of prompts, which I find really helps, because it gives you, kind of focuses the mind. So one of them is, what's the best book you've given as a gift or received as a gift, or what book did you love as a child? And it's much easier to focus that way. But I am a bit of a sadist, because after they've picked their five, I do make them pick an ultimate number one favorite. And I have to say, it was loosely inspired by Desert Island Discs, which is another podcast which I love. So if the BBC are listening, please don't sue me. It's a respectful homage, shall we say.
Absolutely. And do you find that your guests find it really, really hard to choose an ultimate favorite?
Oh, yes, absolutely. And even choosing the five, sometimes I get emails saying, oh, for this one category, I had a tie, or like I get, please, can I have one more? And I'm like, well, some people I say yes to, because I'm like, well, you know, it's my podcast and I make the rules. But other people I want to know, because, you know, you only get a short amount of time to record it. And so you want to make sure you're covering the interesting things you want to talk about.
So Phoebe, when I invited you onto the Brighton Book Club radio show and podcast, I asked what specifically you wanted to talk about. And I was really interested in what you said, because you said you'd like to talk about the backlash against constant working in self-help books. And I would love you to talk a bit about that.
Yeah, so I have noticed a bit of a mini trend. I don't know how many books you need to be a mini trend. So recently I read Grace Beverly's. If you haven't heard of Grace Beverly, she's the founder of Tala and Shreddy. She's quite an influential businesswoman. However, she's only, I believe, four. She was definitely in the Forbes 30 under 30. And she recently brought out her book, which is called Working Hard or Hardly Working. And interestingly, the subtitle is How to Achieve More, Stress Less and Feel Fulfilled. Now, this book is really about kind of how to structure your working life. And her book really focuses on increasing your productivity and maintaining a good level of work-life balance to allow your brain the kind of creativity it needs to think outside of the box and find creative solutions. And as a CEO, she obviously needs that. So I read that book and I was like, oh, that's a really interesting thought. And then I saw another book by Elizabeth, and I'm sure I'm going to butcher the pronunciation of her last name, Elizabeth Ubervene, who is better known as one half of the Slay in Your Lane duo. And if you don't know them, they had a 2018 book which was described as the Black Girl Bible, and I really recommend that book as well. But Elizabeth has brought out a book this year called Reset, and it's the idea is to change how we work and live. And I just think that it can't really be a coincidence that two of these influential women have brought out similar books advocating a wider rethink of modern working structures in a very short space of time, and also coinciding with a global pandemic. Obviously, I don't know when they began writing or when they pitched their book to their publisher, but I'm thinking this might be a bit of a mini trend.
Absolutely. We had Claudia Hammond on the show a couple of months ago, who's written a book called The Art of Rest. And it's about just taking that time for yourself every day. And it's kind of anti that, you know, constant working, always busy, always stressed culture that we've so easily found ourselves in.
Yeah, exactly. And Elizabeth's book is all about how, you know, particularly millennials in the world are looking for something more. We don't want to work 9 to 5 in an office, you know, 50 weeks a year, but that's just not going to happen anymore. We want a bit more kind of flexibility. And it's interesting what you say about the book about the art of rest. So I you know, thought this is a bit of a trend. Maybe it's kind of coming up. And I am actually part of a nonfiction book club. And they had a book which we read there, which was actually released back in 2016 by Alex Pang. And it's called Rest, Why You Get More Done When You Work Less. And it looks at a lot of previous influential thinkers and writers in history and assesses their situations. And it kind of comes to the conclusion that they worked for a very intense period of time. So maybe 4 hours a day, either in the morning or the middle of the day or the evening, based on when they were most productive. Use the rest of the work day to kind of respond to letters and do other tasks. So I think that there's something to be said for kind of condensing your working hours. And I really enjoyed that book, and it's written by Alex Pang. But my kind of one criticism of that book is it focuses heavily on privileged white men. So he focuses a lot on Charles Dickens, who we've all heard of, great author, not saying he's not a great guy. But again, he was someone lucky enough that he could generate a full-time wage, which supported himself, his wife. And I think they had at least 5 children, from what I remember. Mm. And he also had servants, so he didn't need the life admin that the rest of us have now, you know. Yeah. What are we going to have for dinner? Where's my, you know, where's my gym stuff? Like, just general kind of life functioning. But I do think the premise is sound, that from all of these books, that you just can't be at 100% productivity for 12 hours a day. The brain just doesn't work that way.
Absolutely. What is the best book, Phoebe, that you've read recently that you would like to recommend to our listeners?
So the best book that I've read recently is called The End of Men. And I realise I'm kind of getting a bit of a pandemic vibe here. So The End of Men is written by Christina Sweeney Baird. It came out last month. And I was lucky enough to win an advanced review copy in a giveaway that she did. And the book is about a pandemic that hits the earth, which originates in Scotland. And women are fine, but it wipes out 90% of men. And it's such an interesting concept. And I read it, and the book is kind of split into very short, digestible chapters from different perspectives of different women as the pandemic unfolds. And again, I did actually ask her, and she said, no, I had this idea way before COVID was even a thing, because as we know, publishing, editing can take time.
Yeah.
And it was just amazing. I couldn't put it down. I tore through it.
That sounds absolutely wonderful. Phoebe, thank you so much for joining us today. How can we find you and follow you and subscribe to the Off the Shelf podcast?
So I'm on Instagram at Pause Books, one word. My podcast is called Off the Shelf, and it's available on all good podcast providers, Apple, Spotify, that kind of thing. And obviously, before I go, I can't not plug your podcast again. If you're going through grief, if your mother is ill, The Mother of All Losses, the best podcast you'll ever need in your life.
Well, I mean, you know what? I'm never going to stop anyone from promoting me and the podcast. And yeah, that is right. I am the Mother of All Losses is a project that myself and my friend Emily Benita have created to basically kind of unpick, discuss and wade through the lacuna of grief, death, dying and losing a mother. So I would recommend that if you are supporting someone who is grieving, anticipating grief, or if you yourself have lost your mother. Thank you very much, Phoebe. Annie Garthwaite is setting up a fund to help underrepresented writers go on Avon courses. I'm really glad that Annie's able to join us on the Brighton Book Club today to talk about this project and tell us more about the importance of Avon courses in her writing. Annie, welcome to the Brighton Book Club.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
How did this project start for you?
I look back on my life and I was inspired to write by 2 fabulous teachers when I was in my comprehensive school in the northeast of England. And I had a fabulous history teacher and a fabulous English teacher who just, you know, lit the fire under me. But that's a very, very long time ago. I'm in my 50s now and have finally written my novel. But I'm very conscious that this wouldn't have happened if it weren't for them. And I look at the way things are for school children right now and how difficult it is for them to get, you know, fabulous introductions to writing and to the whole creative experience. Not just because school budgets are so constrained at the moment in state schools, but also, you know, we've just coming out of a year of lockdown and COVID when their education has been really compromised. And I just thought, wouldn't it be great to be able to give kids the opportunity to write? So that led me to Arvon. I've attended Arvon courses myself as an adult, but they run a whole schools program where they bring young people from, chiefly from state schools, you know, state schools who wouldn't otherwise be able to afford it, on these week-long immersive writing courses. And they work with tutors and with established authors, and they just have the most amazing experience. So I thought, well, it's payback time. So it costs £5,000 to send a bunch of young people on one of these courses for a week, 16 students for a week. So I thought, well, if we can raise £5,000, we could change the lives of 16 young people potentially. And that seems really worthwhile to me.
What do you think it is, Annie, about retreats that can be so important for writing, about kind of getting out of your regular setting and being creative?
Oh, I just think that it's, you know, we're so surrounded by noise and bustle and demands on our time in our normal lives, and not less so for young people than for us grown-ups. You know, there's so much else going on. And I think when these groups get together, they just bond really quickly. I don't know if you've been on retreats yourself, but you know, you leave after a week of writing with this bunch of people and you feel like they're all your best friends and your family. It's not just the lessons, but it's the time you spend eating and drinking and talking and, you know, just sharing the experience together. And it's very supportive. Writing is a very sort of isolated experience. You do it on your own. So for writers in particular, I think getting together with a group of people who are all striving to do the same thing and celebrating your successes and working your way through your difficulties is just second to none experience, really.
Absolutely. Now, Annie, how are you going to decide which lucky young people get to go on the Arvon course? What's the criteria?
Well, they have to be from a state school. And they have to be really from a school who would themselves be very challenged to find the funds to pay for this course themselves. So the actual decision about which school will get the prize will be made by the folks at Arvon. I will step back from that entirely. But I really would, if any of you out there listening to this, to teachers in state schools, look up Arvon Foundation, read about their school's program, and really think about whether you could take a group of your children.
So how can people support the project, Annie, and give their hard-earned cash to this wonderful cause?
Well, all you need to do is go to www.crowdfunder.co.uk/Arvon, and you will be able to make your donation, and you'll be able to see a little video of me wittering on about what a good thing it is. And I would really urge you, it's very simple to give a little bit of money, and it will make such a big difference to these young people. It'll make such a big difference to their lives. And you know, I would take the opportunity now to just say thank you to all the people who've already donated. You know, our target is £5,000. We launched the fund a week ago today. And when I just checked before I came online with you this morning, we've already raised nearly £3,000. I think that's amazing. I'm just bowled over by how generous people have been. So, you know, let's really push this, because, you know, if we can raise £5,000, that's 16 children that can go. If we can raise 10, do the math, it's 32. You know, the more we can do, the better, the more opportunity that we can give. So www.crowdfunder.co.uk/Arvon.
Now, Annie, let's talk about your book. So Cecily is out soon, and this book has been a long time in the making, hasn't it? Can you tell us more about it?
As I say, I first got inspired about the history behind this book when I was at school. It's set during the early years of the Wars of the Roses. And its main character is a real woman called Cecily Neville. And you might not have heard of her, but she was the mother of two kings who you will certainly have heard of, Edward IV and Richard III. And she just had the most amazing life. She was born in the year of Agincourt in 1415, lived until 1495. So for 80 years, she was right at the heart of politics in probably the most tumultuous period of British history. And she was a real force to be reckoned with. But history and novelists have rather neglected her, I think. So I thought it was time to bring her back to life.
Annie, can you read some? I'd love to hear it.
Yes. Well, I'll read a little bit to you from perhaps the beginning of the book. And we first meet Cecily when she's 16 years old. And she's in France with her husband. And they've come to France to see the crowning of Henry VI as King of France. But another big event happens while they're there, which is, if you know your history of that time, the burning of Joan of Arc. So that's how the novel opens. So I thought I'd read a little bit to you from that. 30th of May, 1431, Rouen, France. It's no easy thing to watch a woman burn. A young woman who has seen only three more summers than yourself and claims the voice of God compels her actions. But there it is, the day's work, and she must harden herself to it. So, on a May morning so fine, this early sun has already chased Rouen's street dogs into shadows, Cecily has put on black velvet, somber and rich. She has bound a rosary at her waist, a reminder to the French that God has answered the prayers of the English and delivered Joan of Arc into their hands. A reminder to her king that her loyalty is to him and to heaven.
Annie, it's such an interesting concept for a book. The research of this must have taken years.
Oh, God, yes. I mean, in a way, you could say that I've been researching this book for 40 years, because I guess, well, as I say, I first got interested in it when I was at school. And my interest first was captured by Cecily's son, Richard III, and, you know, the whole drama about his life, what sort of a man he was. So I was captivated by him and obsessed by him, really. But then the older I got, the more I was reading, the more I read about the period, the more I read about him, the more interested I became in the women around him. You know, there was just some fantastic women in that period of history. You know, there's Elizabeth Woodville and Margaret Beaufort and Marguerite of Anjou. And I just kept getting in, I was intrigued by them, but I kept thinking, you know, there's another woman here that we're not seeing, that seems to be hidden from us, and it's Cecily, you know, it's his mother. So by the time I was in my 30s, I was very clear that the novel, when I wrote it, would be about Cecily. So I've been reading and voraciously about this period and about her for the best part of 40 years.
Annie, how can we get our hands on a copy of it, and when is it out?
It will publish on the 29th of July with Penguin, and you can pre-order it now through all your normal channels. So, you know, walk into your local independent bookshop or order it online through Waterstones or bookshop.org or Amazon, any of those places that you would normally buy books.
And Annie, how can we find and follow you and keep tabs on this wonderful Avon fundraiser?
Well, I would definitely encourage you to go to my website, which is www.anniegarthwaite.com, nice and easy. Or do follow me on social media at just on Twitter and Instagram at just at Annie Garthwaite, or on Facebook at Annie Garthwaite Writer.
Annie, thank you very much for coming on.
Oh, you're most welcome. I've really enjoyed it.
Our book club book this month is Anna Bailey's Tall Bones, and in a moment KD Books from Instagram and YouTube will join me to discuss it, but first here is the blurb and some of your thoughts. When 17-year-old Emma leaves her best friend Abby at a party in the woods, she believes, like most girls her age, that their lives are just beginning. Many things will happen that night, but Emma will never see her friend again. Abby's disappearance cracks open the facade of the small town of Whistling Ridge, its intimate history of long-held grudges and resentment. Even within Abby's family, there are questions to be asked of Noah, the older brother whom Abby betrayed, of Jude, the shining younger sibling who hides his battle scars, of Dolly, her mother, and Samuel, her father, both enthralled to the fire and brimstone preacher who holds the entire town in his grasp. Then there is Rat, the outsider, whose presence in the town both unsettles and excites those around him. Anything could happen in Whistling Ridge, this tinderbox of small town rage, and all it will take is just one spark, the truth of what really happened that night out at Tallbones. So I asked you guys what you thought over on Twitter and Instagram, and Kathy Caton, who you might know from Brighton Gin, said on Twitter that it is so, so good and so tense, they found it hard to read in places, that it had an amazing sense of place and a panoply of rich, damaged characters, while Rhiannon on Instagram said that she's enjoying the soporific feel of a small town and its secrets. It's gentle, but keeps you hooked. So, KD, what did you think of Tallbones?
I mean, how to follow those comments? They were fantastic. I think for a debut, I think we have to give Anna Bailey her due. I think she writes with, like, as if she's wrote way more than what she has done here. And I think in regards to, like, this tinderbox that the Bloom makes out, it's actually not that. It's a lot more tense than that. It's a bit like dynamite. When this book does start and when it gets going, I mean, the tension completely builds. What about yourself?
Absolutely. Now, were you surprised when you found out that Anna Bailey was, in fact, not from small town America? Because I was.
I actually had read that at the back first, because I thought that's where the blurb would be. But my hardcover, it was her biography. But I will say, in regards to Colorado and maybe in regards to this book, it does feel as though it plays on stereotype quite a lot. So I feel as though it was very rudimentary of what I would expect America and Colorado and small town would be, especially in the roles of, say, the role of the preacher, what he is preaching, as vile and abhorrent as it is throughout this book. I do feel that it does fall on stereotype. I feel as though there was some nuance for me that there was missing. But if you're looking for, like, a good place to start of, like, a crime thriller, I definitely wouldn't turn your nose up on it.
Absolutely. Now, it wasn't a kind of conventional thriller, and I don't know how big a reader of thrillers you are, but it relied on kind of character and place as much as the plot, which, and often I find thrillers can really be let down and have quite two-dimensional characters and kind of slightly poor writing in place of a really gripping plot. How would you respond to that in terms of this book?
I would definitely say, in regards to the dual narrative of how we move from the past to the present, there's control there. There was not one time where I was lost or felt as though I had missed any information. And the characters, even though, as I said, it does fall on stereotype, what I do like about this book is that they become, either they fall on their stereotypes, like on their sword, or they do reflect on those stereotypes and see what comes after. But everything's kind of very deftly controlled. Like, I never felt as if, I never felt as though I was being led a red herring down the way.
Felt in safe hands with her.
Mm-hmm. Yes, that is, like, a good way of saying it. Mm-hmm. Very safe hands.
It's really funny that you say that about the stereotypes, because actually, I don't know really where I completely land on this, but many stereotypes in books are kind of there for a reason. And I wonder if Bailey had completely subverted everything the whole time, it would have completely distracted from the plot and seemed too try hard. But there's a familiarity in stereotypes that means that we can focus on different things in the story.
Oh, yeah. I can go with that. I think in regards to stereotypes, I feel if I could draw on Rat, who is the outsider, the fact that he's Romanian, but we have that one Romanian word that continually follows. I think that's probably where sometimes the characters do have their sticking points, or the fact that the abusive father continually is abusive. I don't think that there was ever time of pause and reflection. Again, some characters do have that, which I appreciate towards the end of the book. But I think towards the midway, I felt as though I kind of knew who the characters were, what they were doing, and how they were going to act.
That's a good point. That's funny what you say about the father, because actually I thought some of the flashbacks to the Vietnam War and to his relationship with his mother, I mean, I would never say justified his behavior, but did kind of give some depth to the explanation of him. So in general terms, let's talk about what kind of books you love and what you've read recently that you'd recommend.
I'm probably known for loving the Booker Prize, and I was very lucky this year to be gifted the entire long list for the International Booker. And as of yesterday, I've finished every single one of the 13. So I recently finished The Employees by Olga Raven, which is definitely worth something picking up. It's a space odyssey about humans and humanoids and those in between. Not everything's very clear cut, and how they interact with these objects. It's all told through testaments. But if anyone has read, I'll definitely look at the acknowledgements and who she dedicates it to, because it's all conceptual artists. Mm-hmm. And I would recommend have a look into that artist's work and kind of see where Olga has really brought her inspiration from. Even the front cover is very much reminiscent of one of the artists she mentions. And I would highly recommend that.
So who's going to win, and who should win, in your opinion?
Who should have won? I mean, my top three books never made it to the long list. Wow. So if I could happily recommend my winner, it would be Judith Shalansky's An Inventory of Losses, which is absolutely fantastic, a wonderful exploration on memory and what it is to lose things and what we gain from losing. But I think I'm going to go for the book that I haven't read a positive review about bar mine, which is Eric Willard's The War of the Poor, which is a slim 66, I don't even know if you could call it a novella, about Thomas Munzer. And it's a homage, or maybe a pastiche, towards the pamphlet and the Gutenberg press and what it was to get works into a lot of people's hands as quickly as you possibly could. So I think my money's on Willard.
Interesting. Well, you heard it here first, guys. Thank you very much, Katie, for coming on the show.
Thank you very much for having me. It's been fantastic.
Thank you for listening to the Brighton Book Club, and thank you to all this month's guests. Our next book club book is The Bread the Devil Need by Lisa Allen Angostini. If you'd like to get involved in the show, pick up a copy direct from local publisher Myriad Editions' website or your local bookshop, and let us know what you think. If you've missed any of our shows, don't worry. All the Brighton Book Club episodes are available as a podcast. Just search for the Brighton Book Club wherever you get your podcasts from. If you are planning to do things this summer, now lockdown is easing, can I recommend that you head down to The Warren? It's at Victoria Gardens in Brighton. It is open until the 11th of July and has a great lineup of comedy, music and performance. I'm particularly excited about the Music of Amy Winehouse event and Julie Madley Deeply, which is the Julie Andrews tribute cabaret act. If you've got kids, I've heard that The Snail and the Whale is absolutely excellent and is on in early June. Have a look at the Warren Festival website and click What's On to get tickets. I'll be going as much as possible. Follow us on Instagram at BTM Book Club and email us with your suggestions for the show at btmbookclub@gmail.com. Take care of yourselves, and we'll see you next month.